Leadership is far less about evaluation and judgment that a lot of people have. It's much more about empowerment and leadership and clearing the deck so people can do what they know how to do.
And that's, I think, what the job of a leader is in a startup. You don't have so much data, but you have powerful stories, and you can see how those stories carry you onto the left lane and allow you to overtake everyone.
Probably the most common area that I've seen leaders fail is ego.
Hello and welcome, dear Lightwolf listener. My name is Stefan, I'm your podcast host, and today I am very particularly excited to share some terrific news with you. This episode today is very different from the usual ones. And I feel proud to have something very special to share with you. A live recording of an event that is close to my heart. The Procter & Gamble 2025 Global Alumni Meeting in Berlin. This makes me feel a bit emotional because the two leaders I interviewed are exceptional and very close to me. There in Berlin, I had the pleasure of discussing highly relevant leadership topics of now, today and tomorrow with David Taylor, former CEO and president of Procter & Gamble, and Daniel Dippold, founder and CEO of Evor, an exceptional tech startup ecosystem. The title of this fireside chat was Former P&G CEO Meets Tech Entrepreneur, Redefining Leadership in Times of Uncertainty. This was exceptional because they are both unusually strong and successful leaders. And it was exceptional because they come from so very different worlds. David Taylor has led a 108,000 people organization that is about $80 billion of sales every single year, where growth is continuous. And David and Daniel is the founder of an ecosystem where growth is just exponential and unusually fast as going business. And having those two discussing leadership topics of the future was just an experience that I'm glad to share with you. Among others, we discussed topics like the following ones with about 500 senior leaders from all around the world. What can leaders give to others? Security or just clarity? The value of mathematics for effective leadership. One-way decision-making versus two-way door decision-making. Or the essence of good leadership in just one word by both David and Daniel, and many more. And since I'm convinced that these ideas are also exciting and valuable for our Lightwolf community, I decided to share them in this conversation with you today. And now, enjoy and be inspired by this very special live recording.
Yeah, a wonderful good morning, everyone, and welcome to a fireside topic that could not be more timely. Redefining leadership in times of uncertainty. I'm absolutely thrilled to introduce two exceptional leaders from two very, very different worlds. The entrepreneurial energy and speed of a tech founder, and the experienced, values-driven stability of a global giant, a global giant FMCG CEO that you all know. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Daniel Dippold and David Taylor. Exceptional men, outstanding success. Let's start with Daniel. Daniel is a serial entrepreneur whose ventures total over 300 million in value 4 years after starting. Angel investor in more than 50 startups and funds, including 6 unicorns. He studied at Cambridge, founded and now runs as a CEO, Evor, a tech venture platform with founders like Paul Müller, CEO of Adjust, a company that accelerates apps, and exited at $1.2 billion just after a few years. And Petter Made, he is the co-founder of SumUp, arguably the most successful fintech startup ever, 10 years after founding $8 billion of valuation. And I recently met Daniel Evor and his network, and I was absolutely impressed by the exceptional quality of people that Daniel managed to surround himself with. 5 years ago, also together with four partners, Otmar, myself, and Daniel, founded the NewNow Group, an AI company based in Frankfurt and in Vienna. So this is Daniel, and I'm proud you're here. Impressive. And to his right, David Taylor. David spent 42 years at Procter & Gamble, a Duke graduate, joined P&G as a production manager, and ultimately served as chairman, president, and CEO. Today, he advises Clayton, Dubilier, and Rice, and is the chairman of the board of Delta Airlines and Appella, the Sanofi spin-off. I had the privilege of reporting directly to David for 3 years. David, a true honor. David Taylor.
Thank you.
Today we are after real insights. So let's explore what it takes to lead when certainty is gone. When geopolitics change every single day. When pressure is high and when certainty has to come from within. So first question to you, David, and I know you love growth mindsets. How do you keep a growth mindset even under pressure?
The first comment I'd say is the one thing we cannot give is certainty. The one thing we can give is clarity. And one of the things that I believe very strongly, especially in times when there's tremendous pressure and uncertainty, it can be an amazing catalyst for change because people are looking for direction. And I can think of many times in my P&G career and then recently with Delta, you think about an airline when COVID hit and you parked 800 planes, almost your entire fleet parked what you're going to do the next day. During those times, how a leader acts is going to have a tremendous influence on the employees, the customers, and the communities in which they operate. And I think many choose to hunker down, and to be the leaders that are leading companies that are responsible choose to step forward at that time. And you reorient what the priorities are. And the same thing happened, frankly, to P&G at COVID, and we'll talk that later. Getting clear on what is really important in the short term in the time of a crisis is critical. And typically, it's something different than profit or cash flow. It almost always should start with people. Because if you can take care of your people in those times, the companies that have done that and done that really well engender a tremendous level of ownership and, frankly, connection to the company that pays dividends for years to come. And certainly I've been the benefactor of that with P&G. We've been through ups and downs of the 42 years I was there. And I never questioned whether P&G was going to be there tomorrow, or whether P&G supported me or my coworkers. And to me, that view of a growth mindset says when something really tough happens, how do you use that as a catalyst for positive change? And positive change at some point in time may mean just connection and relationships with people, taking care of people. Done well, to me, it allows you, one, to navigate the change or navigate the issue, but also come out in a positive way. Because the counter of that is a fixed mindset. And think about it, a fixed mindset at a time of change is almost the definition of failure because you have to do something. And the growth mindset is, you know, we always kid around in those that have been through the training is, you know, there's a magic word that opens the mind. We don't know how to do it yet. And all of a sudden, okay, well, then there are options as opposed to we've never done that before, but we haven't done it yet. We just haven't thought of the right way. And to me, smart people can find a positive path out of any situation, and at least that I've been in the business context.
Awesome. Thank you, David.
Daniel, your LinkedIn profile reads, quote, math nerd turned entrepreneur, unquote. Now, I know how much you love and master math, but how does your love for math help you succeed as an entrepreneur?
It's a great question. A quick comment on what David just said on growth mindset also. It's one of the most important things when we're hiring at Ebor as well. Like, we're filtering massively for growth mindset, and we have a whole catalog of questions to kind of filter for this. But to answer your question about math, I think anything can be understood as a mathematical function. And math, in my opinion, provides the clarity.
Yep.
And then leadership provides the energy. So it's not enough to just see the function, but it's certainly really useful. If we, for example, look at what Ebor does, right? We run this founder fellowship, we take a stake in the companies, and then we want them to grow really big, right? We can understand it in like three different functions. The first function we call attraction. It's basically a mathematical optimization problem. We need to generate as many applications as we can and the right ones, right? So last year we got around 35,000 people to apply to this. This is a mix of different channels, which is a marketing function, and every channel performs in a different way and informs each other, and you can map this, and a better understanding gives more clarity. And then selection comes, and we just had this quarter discussion. There were 150 people in the final decision stage, and a year ago we would have accepted them all, but we can accept 35, right, which is 0.5% of all people who apply. So we need to make a decision on those final 150, break them down to eight, and that's a confusion matrix in the end. You need to optimize for true negatives, false negatives, and get that number down to zero. And understanding mathematically that it makes more sense to start with reducing the false negatives and then the false positives is important. So that gives us the clarity. And then, of course, leadership needs to bring in the energy to make it all happen. And maybe a last example on the amplification side, if you truly understand the math behind venture, where you have no Gaussian environment, no normal distribution curve, you have a power law, and some of the companies, they drive all of your return. We have one fellow now, their company is worth $3 billion, 2.5 years after inception. That is driving the majority of our return. And our job at Ebor is to fuel that power law distribution and our understanding of power laws and what is useful within that environment is incredibly important. So understanding this mathematical function is critical, and that's the first part of where it really helps. And the second part is, of course, I can talk to Ebor fellows in a very mathematical and technical way. We've invested in nuclear test reactors, underwater flywheels, foundational models, and we need to be able to discern whether something is a good foundational model or not. And doing this is basically math at the end of the day, translated into code. So being able to speak the same language when discerning whom to back and whom not to back is also incredibly important. That's why many people at Ebor come from a technical background.
Yeah. Thank you, Daniel. And for you guys, I've met Ebor twice. Once in Gothenburg 1.5 years ago. Who here in this room could imagine that your own heart could be 3D printed to replace your current heart? Hands up. Very few hands go up shyly. And until Ebor in Gothenburg, Daniel, until you invited me to come, I would have said clearly no. I wouldn't be able to imagine. But I now met the gentleman, Mark, from the UK, who's working on it, and who has a clear plan laying out, look, in 10 years, we're gonna have it ready enough to replace current surgeries, which is done with pig hearts. And in 10 more years, we'll replace your heart with your own 3D printed DNA, stopping shortage of transplantation organs and avoiding rejection of transplanted organs. That's the kind of breakthrough companies that's inside your Ebor venture. Now let's dwell on one thing, Daniel. I recall that when we met and when you started your company 4 years ago, you screened a few hundred companies per quarter. A year later, you screened 1,500 per quarter. And reading your letter, you screened 15,000, probably in the last quarter of 24. Just selecting 15 to be invested into. Building on David's thought, how do you find out growth mindset in your algorithm?
The short answer is, it's not possible. I mean, we try to apply a series of filters, right? And I talked earlier with David about, like, hey, how can you choose people who join P&G, like, as their very first job, and then they end up being the CEO of the company, right? Like, how do you maintain the system? And it's effectively a set of filters, right? And for us, it's the same thing. Like, we have a bunch of applications, and then, of course, in the beginning, we need to kind of do this all in written form, right? So we're filtering for like outlier spikes, because growth mindset generates empirical data that we can look at in order to discern who has one and who doesn't, right? So this is something we can do in the written application. And then, of course, we can use AI. We don't have any algorithmic decision purely based on algorithms at Evo so far. Like, every application gets looked at. However, what we use a lot, also what we did a lot at New Now, right, is decision-making intelligence. So we have a system that runs in the background, and when someone applies, there is a similarity search, similar to what OpenAI does, between their slide deck and all people who ever applied. And that similarity search compares those two companies in a vector space and basically says, look, 500 people have applied with this very same idea, and this idea doesn't seem to be very different. Whereas another application might read, and that's purely based on the tech we've built, 500 other people have applied with this, but this person is doing two things that are very different about what the others, that the others aren't doing. And then we can look at this and make faster decisions. So the algorithms at Ebor actually come in to help us make faster decisions and analyze data faster. And then, of course, we come into the interviews. And then when we do interviews, we already have a prepared set of questions. We have AI doing the market sizing for us, which is typically way more accurate than what people show in their pitch decks. And, and then we can calculate with them in the calls, right? And we have a lot of aided decision-making there, but the final judging is always based on like intuition on the human side, meeting intelligence on the technical side. And if we combine those two, we realized we make really strong decisions.
Awesome. Yeah, thank you. And reassuring that the human still plays a role beyond the math alone. Now, question to the audience. Since we are running our own business, we've served about 11,000 leaders like you. And at times we ask a question, which is, if you ran your career again, what's the one thing you would do differently? And it has to do with what you say, i.e. decision-making in the fog. Show of hands, who of you has ever regretted taking a big decision too late? Hands up, please.
Oh, gosh, everybody.
Yeah, it's almost everybody.
That's right. Who is not telling the truth?
And that's my next topic for you. Let's start with you, Daniel. When we met in Morocco a few weeks ago, I heard you say, speed of decision making. I'm taking about 99.5% of my decisions fast, and about 0.5 of my decisions more slowly. Now help us distinguish. How do you distinguish between those many you take quickly and those few you take more time for?
Yeah, we actually use a framework from Jeff Bezos, the kind of two kind of doors. I don't know if the people in the audience know it, right? There's one-way doors, two-way doors, and that's incredibly useful for us at Ebor as well. There are just some decisions, they're irreversible, right? You can't go back. And those are the decisions where you want to look at all of the data, where you want to take a lot of time, where you want to use your left brain and do all of the abstract thinking you can do. And then on top, of course, look at your intuition and what it tells you and dwell on it and whatnot, right? And then there's the other decisions. They are two-way doors. You can always go back, right? And those, as you say, 99.5% of decisions probably fall into this category. And it's a great framework because it makes it quite discrete, quite binary. In reality, of course, everything is on a spectrum, on a continuum. So we really at Ebor, we try to understand things on how irreversible they are, right? And if they are on the very left side of the spectrum, which is very irreversible, then we make lots of group decisions. Everyone presents data. We try to use as much data as we can. If they're on the right side of the spectrum, we don't care so much, right? And when we started building the organization in the beginning, everything concentrates into you as an entrepreneur, right? So I was just making fast decisions on budgets, and sometimes I didn't even care whether it was the one way or the other. The important thing was just people got a decision, you did it, and the organization could continue. And then later down the line, of course, you can trickle decision-making power into the organization. So you install a leadership team, which there is not, right? When you start a startup, there's just a bunch of people hacking it away. And then at one point you have a leadership team, and then those people should have decision-making power, and they can also have this 99.5 versus 0.5, right? And then suddenly you have more headspace for those. And then at one point they're employing people who are in leadership positions who then have decision-making power and so on and so forth. And at one point there's just this decision-making tree that grows into the organization. And I believe that by now we have a lot of capacity to think about big decisions, because we have probably 10 people or so in the organization. It's still very little if you think about it, that can deeply think about the 3 to 5 most important decisions they do, which accumulates into 50, right, during the year. Whereas in the beginning, you have to kind of concentrate it all into yourself. So you just need to discern. And maybe one last point on how we discern. The first thing is people. So if you affect people in a negative way, if you break values, for example, by not acting of integrity, that's irreversible. You can never go back, because people will remember this, and you have shown that you don't act according to the values, right? So that is, by definition, an irreversible thing if you start breaking those values. The next thing, of course, if it's strategy, right? You need to allocate a huge set of resources. It's technically still reversible, right? But it's on the left side of the spectrum. It just costs you so many resources, right? And we typically say if more than 10% of the resources of the company are bound towards one decision, then we really need to make a group decision and so on. So strategy is kind of the second part. And the third part is it involves regulatory or external changes that are not in our control. And by doing something, we are entering a contract with the external world that we can't go back on, right? So if it's one of those three categories, we know it's probably by definition irreversible.
Yeah. Thank you, Daniel. And I find it very interesting to see how values are one of the non-reversibles for you in a tech startup, and how values are non-reversible for P&G, for everyone here in the room. Right? Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the strongest thing that unites all of us. Now, David, you already alluded to it from your current role as a chairman of the board of Delta Airlines, mm-hmm. but let's go back to that moment. Cincinnati, Ohio, global headquarters of P&G, year 2020. Month, March.
Actually, it was February, but keep going.
A pandemic hits the United States that we later on call COVID. And I would like to understand, there must have been tens of thousands of people in P&G, P&G employees, asking themselves, gosh, what should I do? What did you do?
Everybody was there. It actually hit for all of us at the very end of January is when we got the first call from the folks in China that something was going on in Wuhan. And I was actually traveling in February, seeing many of you. I went to Italy and went to Geneva and then ended in London that week. And that's when it hit. It was, I think, in the mountains in Italy. We started to get reports, and then it started to become more pervasive. I got back to Cincinnati, finished my trip, and then got back to Cincinnati. And the first thing we did is got the leadership team together once it was very evident that there was, one, a lot of uncertainty, but a very, very large health concern, and made a decision that there would be three priorities we would communicate consistently, and did communicate consistently, that would guide our actions. And it was, number one, take care of our people. Number two, and their families. Number two, take care of our customers, consumers. And number three, take care of our communities. And we said, everything else is going to be put on the side for right now, because if we do those three things right, we'll get more and more information. We can decide what to do. But to speak to Daniel's point, those three things, we said, have to be inviolate. We have to address those three. And so we came out and communicated very clearly, people could take whatever action they needed to take care of their person and their families. If that means somebody needed to be out, we allowed that even in some plants. Two is we wanted to make sure that we, where we could, we made products that were needed. In many cases, these are daily use products, as you know, in P&G. We wanted to have them available for consumers. And on some products, there were runs on products in some countries. And number three, and it was very critical to me, is we wanted to be a part of supporting our communities. And we made choices throughout the next several months that amounted to tens of millions of dollars of product donated, of time donated. And frankly, I can remember many of the stories. One of our plants in Italy said, can we come in on Saturday and make product to donate? And they said, we're donating our time. We'll donate the time. P&G, will you donate the materials? We said, yes, because it fit with that third priority. We knew there'd be a cost. We didn't know how long. None of us knew how long. I mean, now you can look back and people can second guess things. But at that point in time, it was extraordinarily unclear what was going to happen. And those three things. We met every week for a good while. We had weekly GLC, Global Leadership Council meetings, and tried to communicate as broadly as we could, and hopefully it got filtered all the way out to every one of our employees at the time, close to 100,000 people. And it hit different countries in different ways, but to everybody, we wanted to be extraordinarily consistent, which is take care of each other and your families, take care of our customers, our consumers, and then take care of the communities. And to me, that, over the next couple months, that, I think, was absolutely the right thing. And I can tie it to what Delta did as well. Delta shut down, had to park 800 planes. I was on the board at that time. Immediately, think of an airline, all of a sudden traffic stopped. They had over 75,000 people, did not lay off a single person. P&G did not have layoffs during that time. Two companies that went through this without laying off. Delta offered and asked anybody that could take a leave of absence so that we can allow those that need the job and need the income, they can keep going. 10,000 people volunteered immediately at Delta to take unpaid leave of absence so that others could continue to work. Both companies dealt with it, to me, in a very principled way, putting at the center of that the belief that if you take care of your employees in tough times, they'll take care of you in the future. And in both cases, both companies then, as things, certainly as vaccines came in and the health situation got better, both companies tended to lead their respective industries.
Awesome. Thank you, David. I think it's a brilliant example of how you lead in times of extreme uncertainty. And I know you well. I think I can expect your answer, but I'm still asking. If you describe the essence of good leadership in just one word, what would it be?
One word, goodness. Is this a test? There was a word up there earlier, but it's trusting your people to do what's right. At the end of the day, I really believe P&G people have a set of values. And while everybody doesn't know what someone's dealing with at the time, I have a deep belief in P&G people will do the right thing, left to their own devices. And at that point in time, we gave a lot of latitude to the plants, to each of the countries, to do what they needed to do to get through that. And to a person, people stood up and rose to the occasion, which is put their organizations first. And I could not have been more proud. P&G's results were a direct reflection of the men and women of P&G, not the leadership. It's that they had the good sense to get out of the way and let the people close to consumers, customers, in plants, in R&D centers, figure out what needed to happen to get through it. Provide as much information, trust your people to do what's right, and support them.
Thank you, David. Now, Daniel, you're running a company that's very different. What is the essence of good leadership to you in tech startups?
Well, the word I'd probably use is rigor. You need to be incredibly fast. You need to make sometimes really hard decisions. We have pivoted 6 times since we started eWAR. We don't even define what the fellowship is. We say every year we just ask ourselves the question, what do founders love? What do they not love? Everything they not love, we just scratch. And everything they do love, we continue doing. And then we innovate and we try to do like 30, 40% new things that we haven't done before, and we test them. And then the fellowship right now that we run is 180 degrees different to what it was 2 years ago, as you know, right? You've seen the evolution of it. And good leadership for us mostly means also making those hard decisions, often upsetting people, like people who've built stuff for a whole year that's just completely being scratched again, right? And then, of course, being able to create the energy in those people to just get going. I really believe that in startups, progress is one of the most important leadership instruments. So you just constantly show progress, progress, progress. There's a book by Teresa Amabile from Harvard who says it's a bigger motivator than appreciation. Well, I don't know if that's true, but we use both of those big time in the organization to just create a lot of energy. So for example, there are daily wins. I post them every day, no exceptions, including weekends. There's always daily wins, and there's always 7, 8, 9, 10 or so, really shouting out what incredible people do. It's in the Slack channel. It really helps me write the investor updates at the end of the month. I just look at those daily wins, so it's a win-win situation. And then we do weekly shout-outs. We do a weekly call where everyone, all of the team leaders talk about the wins. It's just progress, progress, progress. And the mindset is just we're always on the left lane. We're overtaking. That's the only reason of why we can onboard people who've built unicorns and are now joining us full-time. 30% of our employees have started a $100 million plus company, right? So the standard of who's working for Ivor is incredibly high, and we need to show people, okay, we're not there yet, but we're on the left lane and we're overtaking everyone. And it's really the job of the leaders, not just to create this progress, but to communicate it to everyone and to show people that we're on the left lane and that things are moving forward. And that's really the feeling people get, right? Like 2 years ago, everyone was talking about like, hey, like Antler is kind of the big thing. And then people would choose that over us. And then half a year later, everyone who got the offer was choosing us. Then it was kind of Y Combinator that was winning. The last five people who got the YC offer and ours choose us over YC, right? So now it's kind of like some of the Andreessen Horowitzes of this world that sometimes are kind of coming in and like poaching our deals away. We just had a fellow last week that accepted, which was a huge win for us, that turned Founders Fund from Peter Thiel down in order to do the fellowship, right? So that's a completely new thing. And we just constantly need to show people and tell those stories. And it's that that story that makes the difference. It's not data in terms of, oh, this fellow is mapped quantitatively and incredible. No, we need to tell the story to every employee, right? And when that happened, we did a call, a spontaneous call, gathered everyone and said, this is a special moment. This person just turned down one of the best funds in the world in order to work with us. We need to celebrate this, right? And people took off, we celebrated, lots of appreciation. Who made this happen? Who generated the application? Who was part of selecting this person? Let's look at what worked well. And then we took this story apart. And that's, I think, what the job of a leader is in a startup. You don't have so much data, but you have powerful stories, and you can see how those stories carry you onto the left lane and allow you to overtake everyone.
Awesome. So there is trust on the left, and there is progress on the right. And yes, I've had the pleasure to observe you from the beginning, Daniel. When we met, you must have been 24, and I remember a moment when you shared that you had 148 times no from potential investors before you got your first yes, which then fueled your incredible growth to date. How did you sustain these no's?
I think as an entrepreneur, you constantly deal with rejection, right? I think it's just the reality of the world you're in. If you're in a respected organization, you have a brand, and everyone respects that brand. If you're an entrepreneur, you're starting something from scratch, especially if you're young, right? I was 19 when I started my first company, and everyone is like, what are you doing? Go back, do a real job. This is stupid. My parents told me it's really stupid. My university professors told me it's a really stupid idea. Every investor told me it's a really stupid idea. And everyone tells you this is stupid, right? And you somehow need to sustain yourself, right? And it's just what happens, right? You need to constantly deal with no's, and you need to somehow motivate yourself through The kind of long journey of nothing really happening, and I always say entrepreneurship is like a step function, right? You have nothing going on, suddenly it's this, right? And I think what is really important, you just need to anticipate that moment, like up there, and you need to kind of get yourself into the mindset of at one point it's happening, no matter how long things go, right? And I remember the longest drought that I had is actually this year. We were discussing with the German regulator quite a bit, BaFin. I was like, is this a fund? Is this not a fund? We really believe it's not a fund, right? And we couldn't really move forward until we got clarity from them. And then on the 20th February, my dad died. And on the 21st of February, we got clearance from BaFin, and they said, well, you're not a fund, right? And like my whole family, of course, was like, I spent the last month with him in the hospital every day. Everyone was like down there. Like then the biggest update that actually triggered like the most important funding round happened. And all you could do at this moment is I said, okay, the first 5 hours of the day I spent with my family. And there, no one can reach me from 6 a.m. to 11. Like it's just not possible. And then I will get online and I will only work on the race and onboarding the incredible people that we already had in the pipeline, right? We brought the founder and CEO of MyMuesli onto the team. We brought the CEO of Adjust into the team. We needed to raise 60 million at this point because we could. And before that wasn't regulatory clear of whether we could do this. And then in the evening, I had 20 minutes where I said, you guys handle the entire rest of the organization, and I have 20 minutes, and you prioritize what you present in those 20 minutes, and then I will be there listening to everything and then repeat. And I did that for 2 months. I had lunch typically with breakfast with my family, and then there was no time for eating. Like, I showered every third day, and and I just kept going.
What did your girlfriend say about that?
My girlfriend wasn't there. I was with my family, okay, like the whole time. And she wouldn't have. That would have been horrible. Yeah. And then I slept around 4 hours. And that for like two whole months. I looked into, like, now I actually got those, got this removed, but I looked into the mirror after this, and suddenly I had like lots of gray hair on my sides. And there was like 2 months later, I remember it was like the 20th of April, we had raised 60 million. It's like a notary meeting, went until 3 a.m. in the morning. I closed my laptop. Like, some of the working student who started with us at that point was a millionaire. I had like 2 hours of sleep. I stepped into Deutsche Bahn at like 5:30. Went home to my family and had like 3 hours with them, and then the whole PR thing started around like the race and everything, and you get calls from journalists, right? And it's just reality if you build a startup. And I think there's two ways of looking at this. The first way is, well, this is all shit and I need to somehow survive. And the other way, and that's the way I've chosen, is this is where you experience life to the fullest. Like, you have the whole spectrum of emotion, the highest, the lowest. I was on top of the world 3 a.m. after that notary appointment. We'd broken multiple records that were never broken, like in Europe. And then you go back and you are with your family that is still completely devastated because of what happened like a month earlier. And you experience all of those emotions. And you feel all of those feelings in such a condensed way. And I personally, now looking back at this, I find this exceptional. I think this is where you truly experience life to the fullest. People choose to like tombstone and jump down cliffs and so on, and you can have this in your career. And if you reframe what happens to you in life, I think resilience is not really a thing anymore. It's just everything that happens to you is a good thing. And that's how I feel. Like, no matter how hard things get, no matter how many no's I get, it's a privilege to feel all of those things. And that helps me cope.
Awesome. Yeah. Thank you. Your applause.
Remember that when somebody tells you no.
Thank you for sharing these deep and emotional perspectives, Daniel. Now let's take two more. One is on culture, David. I think that's one of the most important things. There is a reason why someone really smart said culture eats strategy for breakfast. And I would add, culture is not what you deserve. Culture is also what you tolerate, right? Because there are things you tolerate and things you don't tolerate. If you look at your long and accomplished career to date, David, has there ever been anything you tolerated for too long?
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure for all of us, there's many, many stories we could say of where we waited longer than we would want to, in hindsight, to act. It's typically on making a choice about a person or a business. And it's tough at P&G. All of us know the relationships we have with people, and frankly, our ownership and our brands causes us at times to be too slow. I would argue when we've been at our best, we know when there's doubt. There's a statement that I've heard that I really like, especially when you're evaluating whether someone is the right fit. When there's a doubt, there's really no doubt. It was the statement made by an individual, actually Nopella, the company that I'm involved with right now is on the board. And to me, it's a powerful thought because what it's saying is you know what you need to do, but you're just not ready to have the courage to make the tough decision. And I think all of us have got many, many learnings of after we've made the decision, be it a brand, be it a person, be it a situation, after it gets so much better. And in hindsight, we go, I should have moved earlier. And all of us ought to have, and we probably do have now, the pattern recognition to say that's happened many times. So if you understand, especially when it's on an individual is not the right fit, then the question is separate what's right for the business and right for the person. Right for the business is make a call now. Right for the person is take care of them and help them with the next step. But don't prolong something that you know needs to be addressed. And to me, it's one of our biggest challenges to be at big academy companies like P&G and many others that many of you may be involved with, which is we can rationalize incredibly well, just another time, just another time. And frankly, we don't have that latitude to be outstanding, because one of the words you said is stable. P&G does not want to be stable. We want to be outstanding, consistent growers. But it's in a formula that's very different than a startup. My son works in a startup, and it's a very different expectation. Having said that, excellence for P&G is defined as sustained top-line, bottom-line growth in a way that generates the capability to do that even better in the future for decades to come. And to do that, it's not stable. Stable typically means you're about to head down. You're either going up or down right now. The world is very, very competitive. And to me, P&G and other great companies, startups or large academy companies, to me, have to keep that hunger that if you're not growing and pushing yourself to the next level, then you're in trouble. And to me, I've been fortunate to work with a number of companies now in the private equity world and as a board member. And when I hear words that start to defend issues, I get very, very concerned, as opposed to be very transparent. We have an issue. Here's what it is. Here's how we're going to deal with it. Here's my role to then act. Leadership is a very active state. You know, there's a number of things we'll talk about later on leadership that I think is very powerful. But one of the things is you have to act. And the action doesn't have to be what you did in the past. In many, many cases, and whether it's in COVID or whether it's what's going on now in the world, tariffs. I mean, every day it could be something different. The level of empowerment needed for companies to succeed is incredibly high. And we have the benefit, to me, in companies like P&G and any company that develops strong, to me, ethos, culture, you have the ability to have confidence that once you give a direction, you've got an empowered workforce that'll make that happen. Yeah. Leadership is far less about evaluation and judgment that a lot of people have. It's much more about empowerment and leadership and clearing the decks so people can do what they know how to do. The bigger the company comes, the more you better be able to delegate, empower, and trust in order to deliver. And I would argue P&G's best days are when we get out of the way with very clear set of choices and principles and then support. Support and develop.
Awesome. Thank you, David. Two final things. If both of you could leave a question or a thought on leadership with the audience, what would that one thought be? Maybe Daniel, maybe you want to start.
I'll probably focus on the ones that want to set up a company at one point, because that's where I believe I can say something useful. And one of the biggest learnings I had, I of course, you know, started the previous company with lots of P&G alums. There's lots of theory around leadership in big organizations, right? And one of the big ones is you cannot ever micromanage. And if I look at the most successful companies I've funded, like many, as you mentioned earlier, now in the billions, like all of those people micromanage at the beginning, right? This is one of the biggest surprises for me that I've seen earlier. And you know, the context of like when you lead an organization, when you kind of shift into something that small, really changes. And I think micromanagement maybe is effective until you're like 10, 20 people, and then you can't do it anymore. But until then, it's really effective. And that's where many of the best leaders fail to kind of set up a company. So the question I want to bring to the room is, what are the assumptions, right, that you've made about leadership, and which of those will change when you start a company? And it's not just this micro macro management thing. There's going to be many more. And if you're able to understand those assumptions, be metacognitive about them, and apply a kind of new set of leadership actions, I think the transition to being a successful leader in a startup will be much easier.
Yeah. Thank you, Daniel. And what's your thought for the audience, David?
Just a couple of thoughts. One of the things that I've now seen, especially in this private equity world that I've seen 45 companies that the private equity firm I worked with owns or has a significant position, probably the most common area that I've seen leaders fail is ego, lack of humility. Because when that happens, high egos close listening to direct reports and others. And to me, that's the kiss of death. When I have someone in front of me that comes to one of the operating reviews and just watch how they interact with their leadership team, and when it's about self, problem, big problem to me. So ego to me is one of the biggest causes of failure. And to me, I think it's an enormous issue. Many people get to very senior levels and they get altitude sickness. They start to believe. It's true. And you've all experienced it. And to me, one of the things that I'd say is the more senior you are and the more respected is, the more you have to really be humble and recognize the way you got there was through learning from so many other people. We all stand on the shoulders of mentors and many other people. And to me, one of the greatest learnings that I got early in my career, and it's one of the most freeing thoughts I've ever got, is I didn't have to be right. I just had to see that the right thing got done. And when you really believe you don't have to be right, you don't have to stand for I, you have to get we to a place that can move to a positive place. Don't be right, do right. And to do that, to me, the best leaders, and we talked this yesterday in the Women's Leadership Forum, the best leaders recognize, surround yourself with a diverse group of people that you trust and value that have a wide range of experiences. And those that have had the widest range of experiences and learnings, you listen to and be a great integrative thinker, you come to the better third way. It's not about self. It's about institutions that can do something. Things that are bigger than any of us, whether it's nonprofit, profit, public, or private. To me, all of us are people that are achievement-oriented. Anybody that started at P&G, we select for people that are achievement-oriented, people that have made something happen somewhere in their background. They just made things happen. And certainly the fact that you're here today is you're people that are investing in your own development to learn from others. I'm here primarily, not to talk up here, is to learn from you all. Yesterday I got to learn from the Women's Leadership Forum and just listen to some marvelous people talk about their experiences. And I'll leave here with better knowledge, a wider field of vision, because we learned. Let the ego go down, support people, and that's what drives to me just the self-growth and frankly, happiness and fulfillment out of life.
Awesome.
Perfect.
Okay. I think this is the perfect way to wrap it up. I would like to thank both of you for your courage and for your candor. I think you've both held up a mirror on what leadership really is today and tomorrow in times of even bigger uncertainty. It has to do with strategy, it has to do with strengths, but it's much more about clarity, about adaptability, empathy, and about being human. So let's carry the spirit forward, wishing all of you a great conference. Back over to Katrin, and a big hand of applause to Daniel Diepold and David Taylor.
This was my live recording of the Global Procter & Gamble alumni event in Berlin, together with David Taylor and Daniel Diepold. I hope you were able to take away as many exciting ideas for your own leadership behavior as I was. I learned a lot. I hope you found a nugget or two for yourself. And if you enjoyed this special episode, please share it with your colleagues and friends who might also like to live leadership with impact. Subscribe to the Lightwolf podcast so you never miss a single new episode. And feel free to write in the Spotify comments what resonated most with you. Please also take a moment to vote in the survey. Would you like to see more live appearances like this here in the Lightwolf podcast? For example, I also have a keynote speech from this event, about half an hour, about my personal three biggest mistakes that I made as a leader and that I would be happy to share with you. So please vote now if you would like to hear it in the Spotify survey. Just say yes or no. Thank you very much for listening and looking forward to welcoming you again soon here in the Lightwolf podcast. Thank you and see you next time.